Ari Hahn is the Anton Vonk Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She specializes in the study of civic and political participation, collective action, social change, and democratic revitalization, particularly as it pertains to social policy and environmental issues. She has published 3 books: How Organizations Develop Activists, Civic Associations and Leadership in the 21st Century, and Groundbreakers: How Obama's 2.2 million volunteers transformed campaigning in America and moved to action, motivation, participation, and inequality in American politics. Her award-winning work has been published in the American Political Science Review, American Sociological Review, American Journal of Sociology, and numerous other outlets. And all of our previously monthly calls are on our website, so you can get to them. It wasn't this January, but the January before that Hari was our guest speaker. I think she's one of the 3 most important speakers we've had on our call, because she had us better understand what we're doing. And we'd like to welcome her here from Santa Barbara, California today by Zoom.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for the welcome, Mark, and for allowing me to speak to you all here. I should start just by apologizing for not being there in person. I was really hoping to be able to be with you all there in person, but we have a 5-year-old son who had a bike accident, and he needed some medical care that kept me at home. So I'm sorry I can't be there with you now, but I'm really looking forward to having the opportunity to speak with you all, and I'm grateful to Mark and to Ricky and to everyone else at the Citizens Climate Lobby that has made this possible. So what I want to do today is talk to you all about some of the work that I've been doing, trying to understand the ways in which organizations like the Citizens Climate Lobby can try to get people engaged in politics, right? We're in this political moment now where the work that that you guys are doing in some ways is probably more important than anything else in trying to get people involved around climate issues. And so what have we learned from studying organizations like yourselves, and what can we learn about how to improve that work? So to sort of start, I thought that it would be helpful to start by talking about how I got into this work and why I do what I do. So I grew up as the daughter of Korean immigrants in Houston, Texas. If you can see the slide, then that little picture of me, of the little girl in the orange sweater, is me. My parents first came to the United States in 1972. They came for my dad to go to school. And, you know, they had come from this family in Korea where they were war refugees from North Korea. They had migrated to the United States. And a lot of what I saw growing up was this effort that my parents made to try to figure out what it meant to raise a family in the United States, right? They took us to Mount Rushmore, they took us to all the national parks, and they tried to help us sort of be, quote unquote, like as American as possible. And I think that what I learned from watching my parents go through that experience is this lesson that really stayed with me for most of my life. And that lesson is the idea that transformation is not only possible, but it's a way of life, right? That a lot of what we do as human beings is try to remake ourselves and remake the world around us so that we can create the world that we want for ourselves, for our families, for our communities. And that was something that I saw in my parents growing up. And I think it's no accident as a result that a lot of what I do now is study social movements, right? How is it that movements work to sort of transform society on not only climate change, but any issue that it might be working on? And the reason why I think it's no accident is that I think movements are a unique form of social change because they build power for change not by selling products that people already want, right? They're not like the company that's trying to sell you ketchup or trying to sell you cereal or something like that, but they work by transforming what people think is possible, right? And at the core of how a movement works is that idea of transformation. And so a lot of what I try to do is try to understand how that works, right? How is it that movements work? So there are 2 things that I thought that I'd talk with you all about today. So first is this question of why is it that we need transformation? And second, how is it that we engage people in transformative ways in the 21st century, right? There are lots of movements who can get a lot of people involved, but how do we get people involved in ways that actually build power for the change that we want? And translate that all that activism that you all are creating on the ground into the kind of political power that we want. So let's start with the question of why transformation. So in my mind, the easiest way to think about this question about why we need transformation is to think about, like, what's the theory of change, right? Like, what's the idea behind why we do what we do? And at its core, right, different kind of problems need different solutions, right? There are certain kind of problems where we need a technological fix, for example, right? Like when we're trying to eradicate polio, what we really needed was a vaccine, right? And until we had that vaccine, we didn't have the technology that we needed to make the change that we want, right? There are other problems where what we're trying to do is raise awareness, right? That when people have the information that they need, they act to make the change that they need in order to create the change that we want. The kind of problems I think where we need movements are problems that are fundamentally problems of power. And I'm using the word power here in a really specific way, right? What I mean by that is in problems of power, the people who want or need the change the most don't have the authority to make it. Right. There are problems that we can solve, you know, that by simply giving people the information, if the people who have the information then have the authority to make the change that they want, then they can do so. Right. But the reason that we need movements is that sometimes the people who want the change the most, right, if we think about in terms of climate, maybe it's our grandchildren, maybe it's our children, right? Maybe it's people in frontline communities who don't necessarily have the capacity to act to make the change that they want, right? These are all situations where people who want the change the most don't necessarily have the power to make it. And so the question is, how do they create that? How do they create that power, right? And the way that we create that power is that we have people who want the change the most work with others to transform the resources that they have to turn what they have into what they want, right? How do they take the resources they have and convert those resources into the resources they need to make the change that they want? And that's what social movements do, right? Social movements are a process of essentially taking the resources of ordinary people, right? Our capacity to meet with our legislators, our capacity to engage with other people in our community. All of those are resources that we can bring that when we put them together, it allows us to begin to make the change that they want. And so there's famously an organizer, Saul Alinsky, some of you may have heard of him, and he famously said that when you have problems of power in American politics, there are two sides that you can be on. You can either be on the side of organized power, of organized people, or organized money, right? That there are two sources of power in American politics. One of them is organized money, and one of them is organized people. And if you're not on the side of organized money, then you should be on the side of organized people. And so in a lot of ways, what I think social movements are what I'm interested in is the question of, okay, well, when we have problems of power in the way that we've sort of talked about it here, then how do you organize people in a way that begins to sort of solve those? And a few years ago, I was thinking about this question, and I was seeing this funny paradox in a lot of the work that I was seeing around the world, right? If we think about the Arab Spring, about Occupy Wall Street, you know, even the sort of groundbreaking work that people like Al Gore did in building the climate movement, there is sort of this funny paradox that we are seeing in a lot of movements around the world, right? On the one hand, it was easier than ever before to get people involved, right? The new technologies, the new tools that we had made it easier and quicker than ever before to connect people who wanted to connect to our movement and get them involved in opportunities for engagement. But on the other hand, a lot of the frontline activists that I was talking to as I was beginning this research were saying, it's true, we can get more people than ever before to do stuff, but we feel like we're powerless, right? We feel like we're not making the change that we need, even though we can get lots of people out into the street in the same way that you know, that the leaders of the Arab Spring were able to do, for example, in Tahrir Square. And so the question that I wanted to look at in some ways is this question of, well, how do we speak to that paradox, right? How is it that organizations can get people involved in a way that actually makes the change that they need, right? How does that work? And in thinking about this question, I looked around at some of the other work that was going on, and one of the things that was so interesting was some work that I looked at by a sociologist named Ziad Munson, and he did this really fascinating study of the pro-life movement, where he was trying to understand how was it that the pro-life movement got all these people involved, right? And these are people, he was looking at people who, you know, organized groups in their community, who would go to protests and rallies, who led groups in their churches. These are people who are sort of real leaders in the movement, much like those of you who are in the room right now. And the question that he wanted to ask was, how did they get all these people involved, right? What were the pathways to activism that these organizations saw? And one of the things that was so interesting that he found was that most of the time, if I was in the room with you, one of the questions I would ask you is, what kind of people do you think join the pro-life movement, right? And what most people say is that, well, we think people who believe in pro-life issues are the people who join the pro-life movement, right? In the same way that we think, who's going to join Citizen Climate Lobby, right? It's people who believe in climate change, right? Or people who are environmentalists, or people who see climate change as a threat and want to sort of take action around it. But one of the most interesting things that Ziad found in doing his work is that of the people that he interviewed, right, the people who are on the very front lines of the pro-life movement, half of them, when they first joined, they were either pro-choice or indifferent to issues of abortion. Right now, I can't see all of you all right now, but I would expect that there are some of you who are surprised by this finding, right? Because we think it's pro-life people who joined the pro-life movement, but in fact, what he found was that half the people, either they didn't really care about issues of reproductive freedom, right? Or they were actually pro-choice. And what he found was that the things that drew people into the movement was not necessarily their belief in the issue, but instead it was the fact that they just moved to a new community and they were looking for new friends, right? Or maybe it was someone who had just retired and had more free time and wanted to get involved in a group in their church or in their community. You know, or it could have been a woman who had her first child and all of a sudden went from being a working mom, working mom to a mom to a stay mom to a stay at home for her to create new ways of getting involved. And so all these people, what happened was that they were drawn into the movement for sort of social, biographical reasons, but then something happened in those meetings where they wanted to keep coming back, right? That even there are a lot of things that I might do for my friend because she asked me to, and I feel bad saying no, so I might go to that one meeting. But for me to keep going back, something has to happen in those meetings that makes me want to continue to go back and go back and eventually kind of lead a group, right? And so that was kind of the question that I wanted to ask, is that how is it that, how do we engage people in ways that actually sort of keep them coming back in those ways, right? How do we engage people in ways that engage that kind of transformation? And so what I did is I went out and I looked at a bunch of groups, mostly environmental organizations, some health organizations also, and was trying to understand what are the difference between the groups that are really good at getting people involved and keeping them involved over time and the other ones that struggle more to do so. Right? And what are the practices that differentiate what I call the sort of high engagement groups from the ones that are sort of lower engagement? And essentially what I did was I went out and one of the things that I found was that there was this real difference in groups that engaged in what I call mobilizing versus organizing, right? And this is a term that came from the activists and the leaders that I was talking to. And one way to think about that is to sort of think about the story of the person who you see on your screen is a young man named Alex Waters. And Alex Waters, I can sort of tell you the story about him. This is one of those moments where it'd be great to be able to see you guys, so I'm sorry that I can't see you. But Alex Waters was a young man. He grew up in Colorado, I think, and he had gone to Iowa for college. And he thought when he went to college that he was going to become a professional golfer. So he goes to college thinking he's going to become a professional athlete. And he one weekend, one of his friends invited him to their parents' lake house. And he thought, this is great. I'm going to go to my friend's lake house and hang out for the weekend. And he's hanging out that weekend and standing at the end of the dock and wearing a hat, and the wind comes by, it blows the hat off his head into the water. And Alex thinks, rats, you know, that's a hat that I really like. I really wish that I could go in and get it. And so he looks at the water and he thinks, well, the water's pretty deep. I'm just going to dive in and get that hat. So he dives into the water thinking that the water was about 18 feet deep. It turned out to only be about 18 inches deep. Okay, so you can imagine what happened. He hurt his neck. He was instantly quadriplegic, and he was life-flighted out of there. He had great medical care, and he was able to sort of get back on his feet and return to college after a few years. And when he returned, his life was obviously very different. And fast forward a few years, and the Obama campaign comes along in 2008, and they're recruiting Alex to become an organizer for the campaign. And Alex thinks, this is crazy. There's no way I can be an organizer. I can't knock on doors. I can't dial phone numbers. I can't even turn on the lights in the office. There's no way you want me to be an organizer. And what the Obama campaign says is they say, well, you're thinking about organizing differently, right? You're thinking about it like mobilizing, right? Transactional mobilizing, which is most campaigns do, right? They hire a bunch of 22-year-olds. You go out, you knock on a bunch of doors, and you try to engage as many people as possible. But what we want you to do is we want you to actually do organizing. We want you to do transformational organizing. And what that means is that we want you to sort of engage other people as leaders in their community so that they're the ones who are talking to their neighbors, it's not you, right? And it turns out that Alex went on to become an organizer in the Obama campaign and was one of the most productive organizers the campaign had. And so that difference about between what Alex thought he was going to do and what he actually did, that's the difference in some ways between mobilizing and organizing. And so one way to think about it is that in any organization like Citizens Climate Lobby, you can imagine that there are, you know, different rungs on an activist ladder, right? At the bottom are people who just say, like, sure, we'll get your emails, but we're not going to fly to DC for a conference, right? And at the top of the ladder are people who actually run the groups in the communities and take responsibility for engaging others. The difference between mobilizers and organizers is that the mobilizers essentially let people self-select onto where they want to be on that ladder. So if someone says, you know, what I really want to do is come in and, you know, attend the monthly webinars but not do anything else, and they say, great, like, we'll let you do that, right? If someone else says, all I want to do is get your emails but not do anything else, and they say, great, we'll let you do that, right? And they let people sort of self-select on to where they want to be on that ladder. What organizers do is wherever people come in on that ladder, they say, great, we're going to, you know, we want to take you in, but then we want to cultivate your capacity to do more, right? If you're not someone who's ever gone and talked to your member of Congress, we're going to train you how to do that, right? If you're not someone who's ever written a letter to the editor, we're going to train you on how to do that, right? So that people sort of constantly develop their agency and sort of move up that activist ladder. And the reason why that's really important is that by cultivating people's agency, right, that what they do is they help people, they help these constituencies, right, the people who need the change the most, kind of achieve the purpose that they want, right? Martin Luther King famously defined agency as the ability to achieve purpose. And so often, I think a lot of people think about agency as this feeling in my head, right? Do I feel like I'm someone who makes a difference? And one of the things that I think is so interesting is that social psychologists who study this, they argue that agency is not just about competence, right? Do I feel like I'm someone who can make a difference? It's also about autonomy, right? Do I have the opportunity to act on my purpose, right? And that's where I think groups like Citizens Climate Lobby are so important, because what Citizens Climate Lobby does is it creates opportunities for people to act and to learn how to achieve their own purpose. And what we see is that if we just look at sort of measures of agency over the past kind of 50 years or so, people's sense of agency in politics has really been declining in the United States, right? It's one of the big trends that we see, you know, so that, you know, a long time ago, people thought that as an ordinary person, they had voice in politics. Nowadays, a lot of people feel like the game is rigged, right? That they don't have the opportunity to sort of say anything. And so what's so important for the groups that are trying to build the power that they need for the change that they want is to figure out how to cultivate people's agency. And the reason why that matters is that if we're not cultivating people's agency, then what's happening is that we're only grabbing the low-hanging fruit, right? So if you imagine that in any community, right, there's a bunch of low-hanging fruit who are people out there that are already on your side that are just looking for opportunities to get involved, right? And mobilizers, what they can do is they create opportunities for involvement to grab all that low-hanging fruit. Right? But the problem is to really make change that's durable, right? To really kind of convince our elected officials to do things that are hard for them to do, what we have to do is not just get the low-hanging fruit, but also get the medium and the high-hanging fruit that's higher up in the tree. And the medium and the high-hanging fruit that's higher up in the tree, that you can only get those through by engaging these processes of transformation. And what's so interesting to me is that if I looked at the difference between organizations that were doing the mobilizing versus those that were doing the organizing, that it wasn't just semantic, right? It wasn't just like a difference in words that they used and how they talked about their work. In fact, it was fundamental to sort of how they structured themselves, the kind of ask they asked their members to do, and the way that they communicated with their members, right? So mobilizers, their strategy for power was, we want as many people as possible to do more things. Organizers, their strategy for power was, we need to have as many leaders like Alex Waters who have that capacity to sort of reach out to people in transformative ways, right? So mobilizers, in order to be able to do that, the kinds of things that they would ask people to do, for example, is to work independently, right? Because we know that it's much easier to do things by yourself than it is to do things with others, right? Like, I teach at a university, and whenever I give my students group work, they always groan, oh, Professor Han, you're making us do group work, right? And no one likes group work because it's such a pain in the butt to have to work with other people, right? And so mobilizers would try to make work as easy as possible for people because they wanted lots of people to do lots of things. But organizers would say, hey, you know, we know that it's hard to work with other people, but we want to put you in positions of working with other people because that's how you become transformed, right? We don't become transformed in isolation. We become transformed when we're in relationship with others. And so, for example, I remember one organization that was doing organizing, and they were trying to run a letter to the editor campaign. What they would do is reach out to their list and say, hey, who wants to write a letter to the editor? And anyone who did, they'd say, great. They would put you in contact with someone else in your community and ask you guys to work together to write a letter to the editor, right? And people might do that entirely virtually. You can do that entirely online. But the act of being paired with someone else in my community to write this letter to the editor, what we found is that people were much more likely to stay involved over the long term, right? And so there's always this question for organizers about how they sort of create those opportunities for people to be in relationship with each other. The last thing that I just want to say is, as we think about this, is that if we think about the kind of political moment that we're in, right, not only in the United States, but all over the world, what we're seeing is the rise of this different kind of politics, right, where there's so much uncertainty. Changing. There's a ton of uncertainty. And on the one hand, we see this outpouring of kind of protest activity, you know, organizations like Citizens Climate Lobby and a lot of the other environmental organizations have just seen this outpouring of interest, right? People who want to get involved since the election because they feel this threat around climate or other environmental issues. And the challenge in some ways is how do we turn this unity that's right now in the face of resistance into unity in the face of common purpose, right? How do we create common purpose where people are going to be able to sort of work together to sort of recreate the kind of work that we need? And in my mind, to be totally honest, like, I don't think that's going to happen without organizing, right? Without the work of people like Citizens Climate Lobby, right, who are going into the communities and trying to sort of organize people to talk to their elected officials, to be able to sort of push the agenda that you want, I don't think there's anything else that's going to happen. The challenge, I would say, in front of organizations like Citizens Climate Lobby is that transaction doesn't create transformation, right? So that right now it's really easy to just sort of draw on that low-hanging fruit. And the challenge is how can we begin to sort of recreate ourselves and our organizations in a way that begins to sort of engage people in the transformative work that helps them give voice so that the decisions that our elected officials make are decisions that help promote the kind of world and the climate that we want for ourselves and for our children and for everyone in front of us. So I will stop there and apologize again that I can't be there in person. I'm excited to hear about how many people have gathered in DC, and I don't think that anyone is doing more important work than the work that you all are doing. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk with you all about some of this stuff.